Today, we're going to be talking about a particularly poisonous toxin called religion. And I just want to tell you, I'm not talking about an anti-Christian cult here. I'm talking about how sometimes, if we're not careful, the church can be a little bit toxic to a lot of people. My suspicion is, perhaps this morning, there's someone here that your last time at church, or maybe a recent time at church, someone maybe judged you poorly. Someone maybe pointed their finger at you figuratively because of how you look, or the way you dress, or the color of your hair, or the color of your skin, or the tattoo that you have, or maybe even the way that you voted in the last election. Maybe for you this is an even more personal issue, where someone in your family or a close friend has become a fanatic, if you will, and they've been trying to bully you into the baptistry. Church can be a little bit toxic sometimes. And maybe it surprises you, I know, to hear a preacher stand up here and criticize the church. But I want to tell you, I've been in a number of churches through the years, and there have been some of them, I'm just going to be honest with you, and if you've visited other churches, let's just be honest, you haven't liked some of your experiences there. I mean, sometimes church is just boring. I hope that we're not a boring church. I mean, that's one of those situations where it's kind of like the news story. Ain't nobody got time for that, right? Nobody has time for boring church. Maybe for you it was that when you entered the church, there were some people who were just bigoted. They were very judgmental and very opinionated and had their prejudices, and they were just plain mean to you. Maybe your experience was involved with a lot of crotchety people kind of scowling down at others who don't talk like them or look like them or act like them, right? Well, church can be toxic, and sometimes I think for preachers it can be a little bit worse. I was born in 1979, in the time of the 80s, and even from then and more recently so, there's been scandal after scandal after scandal involving ministers and preachers and pastors, if you will. Back in the 80s, the big one was the televangelist by the name of Jimmy Baker. Anybody remember him? He was sentenced to 45 years at federal penitentiary for embezzlement. That didn't include the sexual scandal surrounding his ministry. Well, the whistleblower with that was another Jimmy, a guy by the name of Jimmy Swaggart, who got caught with a prostitute. Can you spell hypocrisy? Right? I mean, those are the problems that surround ministry at times, and even church leaders. And maybe you're sitting there thinking, you know, you really shouldn't be talking critically about church leaders. You really shouldn't be talking critically about the church. I just have to tell you, I believe firmly in the Church of Jesus Christ. I believe that the church, even in the midst of her flaws and her failings and setbacks, the Church of Jesus Christ still is the best thing that has happened to society today. I believe that the Church of Jesus Christ is God's mechanism today for spreading the message of salvation in the world. I do believe in the church. If you're offended by some things I've already said, I want to challenge you, just hold your breath and let's take a look at what Jesus had to say about religious leaders of his day. He had some things that were just plain tough to say against religious leaders. We're going to start in Mark chapter 8 this morning. It's a statement where he criticizes the leaders of his day. And I just want to warn you, it might be a little confusing at first. But I hope that we can unpack it together. I hope it will make a little bit more sense to you. So Mark chapter 8, verse 15. Jesus says, "Be careful." Jesus warned them, "Watch out for the yeast of the Pharisees and that of Herod." Well, what's he talking about? Well, first things first, yeast is a microscopic fungus. And yeast feeds on sugar. And so if you take a little bit of yeast and you take a little bit of sugar, and if you mix some water in with it, stir it up a little bit, some amazing things will happen. The yeast will feed on the sugar and it will release carbon dioxide and it will expand. And slowly, over time, imperceptibly, the yeast will permeate whatever else. I mean, you've heard the saying, a little bit of yeast can leaven an entire lump of dough, right? And so if any of you this morning happen to be fans of beer, bread, or wine, you have to like this yeast thing, this microscopic fungus, right? But if you're talking about religion, which we are today, you don't want yeast involved in your religion. Because the yeast of the Pharisees and the yeast of the Herods can permeate, just like this, can permeate your entire religious experience and wreak havoc on it. You need to know that the yeast of the Pharisees and the yeast of the Herod are two very different things, two very distinct things, okay? In fact, the only thing, they didn't get along, the only thing I could find that the Pharisees and the Herods agreed on in all of history is this: Jesus needed to die. That's about it. That's the only thing they agreed upon. Other than that, two very different situations, but both involved hypocrisy. I want to peel this issue one layer at a time. We'll start with the yeast of the Pharisees. The yeast of the Pharisees create fanatics. A group of people, they are into it. And this religion makes you feel good about feeling bad. I'll explain that in just a moment. But maybe you know this kind of religion. It's the religion of the preachers who pound the pulpit. It's the religion of the street evangelists who stand on their soapboxes and point their finger at the sinners as they walk by. It's the religion of jihad, if you will. It's people who are sold out fully to their religion. They are true believers. But the problem is that they think that you have to feel good about feeling bad. I'll explain that. Been in a number of churches through the years, and for some reason, some people get the idea they need to come to church in order to be beat up a little bit. I know that because I've stood by the door as people have left and they've said, "Boy, Seth, you really stepped on our toes this morning. You stomped down hard." But they're smiling. It's kind of like, do you like to come to church and be beat up? I mean, what is wrong with you? But sometimes people have this idea that they need to feel good about feeling bad. And so if you go to church and feel bad, you're going to feel good about feeling bad. It's crazy. But that's kind of the idea of the yeast of the Pharisees. Now, I want to be fair, okay? So in all fairness, you should know, I do think the Pharisees are good people. The Pharisees are the kind of people that they study their Bible because they want to know the Word of God. But somewhere along the lines, in studying the Bible, they've gotten arrogant and sometimes critical of others who don't know the Bible as good as them. The Pharisees are good people. They're the kinds of people who want to follow the rules. But somewhere along the lines of following the rules, they get mean towards other people who don't follow the rules as well as they do. They get judgmental about other people who don't measure up to God's ideal in the way that they think that they should. Pharisees are good people. They want to spread the name of God to the world, but sometimes they spread the name of God with intimidation or sometimes even violence. Question: how do you know if your religion has been affected by the yeast of the Pharisees? The answer is, if your religion is more about externals than it is about internals, then you know you've been infected by the yeast of the Pharisees. And so, these Pharisees, with them, religion is all about how you looked, what you wore to other, all about how you looked to other people, the clothes that you wore, the food that you eat or don't drink, all those kinds of things, the words you say or don't say. It's all about the externals, and the list goes on and on and on. And friends, when your religion is more about externals than it is about internals, when you're not as concerned about the heart and more concerned about what appearances are, sadly, Jesus may say the same thing about you that he said about the Pharisees in Matthew chapter 23. Matthew 23, verse 25. "Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You clean the outside of the cup and dish, but inside they're full of greed and self-indulgence." And if that's the description of your religion, then I have to tell you, you're going to be on the opposite side of the fence of Jesus Christ. What does this actually look like? Well, there are a lot of different examples or illustrations, but perhaps it looks like the story of Linda. Linda grew up in the church, and when she was a teenager, she had a boyfriend, and her boyfriend attended a different church than she did. He attended a church that they didn't use any instrumental aid in worship. No instruments at all. Now, Linda's church, they used the piano and the organ, never the drums. Occasionally a guitar, but very, very rarely, okay? And Linda, time after time, would invite her boyfriend to church, and he would not join her there. And finally she asked him, "Well, do you believe God's going to send you to hell because you go to a church that uses instruments in their worship?" This was his answer: "I just can't take the chance." What kind of a God do you think we serve that would send people to hell using instruments in their worship? I don't understand that. How does a religion like that ever gain traction? Linda's story doesn't stop there. A few months later, her boyfriend wanted her to do something she was uncomfortable with. He wanted her to have an abortion. And I'm just thinking, how do you justify that? How do you justify on the one hand that you can't use instruments in worship, and on the other hand that it's okay to abort, to murder an unborn baby child? How does that ever gain traction? Question: why is the influence of the Pharisees so pervasive? The answer is intimidation. These kind of Pharisees, they make you feel bad when you don't measure up to their standard of morality. Even when their standard of morality is meticulous or ridiculous or judgmental. It's not just the threat of hell that we may fear. It's the threat of being rejected by the Pharisees themselves. There exists some weird, odd, unidentifiable quality of needing the approval of the Pharisees. That's what's going on. That's the danger of the yeast of the Pharisees. They can be intimidating and judgmental because they're more concerned about what other people see rather than what God sees, who sees their heart. And if you've been intimidated or bullied, I just want to share a story with you that I think might be very liberating for you. It's one that Jesus told, Luke chapter 18. In Luke chapter 18, starting in verse 10. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood up and prayed about himself, "God, I thank you that I'm not like other men, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector." And I bet there are people here this morning that have been in church or had an experience where someone has pointed their finger at you, either truly or figuratively, and said, "God, I'm glad I'm not like that person." Here's what the Pharisee continued to say: "I fast twice a week, and I give a tenth of all I get." But the tax collector stood at a distance. He would not even look up to heaven, but beat his breast and said, "God, have mercy on me, a sinner. I tell you that this man, rather than the other, went home justified before God. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted." God is not nearly as concerned about the externals as the Pharisees are. He's interested in our hearts. But when the Pharisees get a hold of religion and the influence permeates all of religion, we can have devastating effects. And so on the one hand, we have the yeast of the Pharisees. On the other hand, we have the yeast of Herod. And the two are very different. The yeast of the Herods makes not fanatics, but frauds. These are the people who want to live one kind of life at church and who live a different life at work. This is a religion that makes you feel bad about feeling good. Herod, like many of you, was a very successful man, a very successful leader. He was powerful politically. He was a builder. As a military man, he was very successful in his campaigns. But friends, his private life was a wreck. And I think a lot of people, if they just separated religion out of things, they could be happy little pagans, you know? I mean, go about their life and they could go about their business and they could make a lot of money and be very powerful. But Herod had just enough religion to make him feel guilty when he was being a pagan, but not enough religion to change his life when he went to work. And I suppose that's where some of us live sometimes. Let me give you a little background on Herod. Herod was not fully Jewish. Herod's mother was a Jew. His father was an Edomite, so he was half Jewish. But he adopted the Jewish religion. And when the Romans made him king, he was especially devout as a Jew, at least when he was in Jerusalem. He helped build the temple. He celebrated the feasts. And to this day, the foundation of that temple is still there. I mean, rabbis will still go to this day and bow down. It's what's known as the Wailing Wall. They'll bow down and they'll write their prayers and they'll fold them up and put them between these 2,000-year-old stones. That's the last remaining remnants of the temple of the Jews. Herod built a phenomenal temple. And so when he was in Jerusalem, he was one way, but that's not where he lived most of the time. Herod lived in Caesarea, which he built, to the honor of Caesar. He was ingenious in his building. In fact, he's the first one in history to figure out how to set cement underwater. So if you go there today, you can still see partial remains from this harbor he built there in Caesarea. You'll also see a hippodrome. That's horse racing. The Romans loved their horse racing. You'll also see a theater. That's what the Greeks loved. And so Herod, when he was around Romans, he could be very Roman. When he was around Greeks, he could be very Greek. When he was around Jews, he could be very Jewish. Herod was a social and political chameleon, if you will. And I know that's where some of us live. But the problem with this, the problem with the yeast of Herod, is it will permeate your religion and falsify it. Herod, though he was successful, was, again, personally, his life was a wreck. He had two sons that didn't like how he led things, and so they kind of planned this coup, and he finds out about it and decides to assassinate them to take out the competition, even though they're his sons. Herod took it upon himself to strangle his favorite wife. He had 9 of them, but his favorite wife, Mariamne, he falsely accused her of adultery and then carried out this death sentence on her. What kind of a man does that, right? He was very religious, but his religion was filled with this permeating influence. And the danger also of Herod's yeast is it not only leavens his lump, but also those of his children and his grandchildren. That's the problem with the yeast of the Herods. It will permeate not just you, but if you're not careful, your children and your children's children. Herod the Great, we'll take for example. As you recall, he's the one that tried to kill Jesus as a baby, right? Send soldiers into people's homes to kill all the infants under 2 years of age, right? To kill Jesus. His son, Herod Antipas, stood before Jesus on the day he died. Had the power to set Jesus free as an innocent victim. And yet he allows Jesus to go to the cross. Herod's grandson, Herod Agrippa I, he assassinated James the Apostle. The first apostolic martyr was beheaded because of Herod the Great's grandson. Another of his grandsons, in Acts 26, we'll get to that later on, but Paul, on his trial headed to Rome, he's going to see the emperor. This guy does nothing to aid in his release. And so generation after generation will be permeated by this toxicity. And so you see this, it doesn't just affect you, but it will affect your kids and your kids' kids and all the way down the line until someone stops. Why is this type pervasive? Why is this influence so pervasive, that of the Herods? It's not intimidation, but it's intoxication. See, we like to have our cake and to eat it too. Right? There's a little bit of Herod in all of us. We want to come to church and be respected here. We want to go to work and be respected there. And somehow, sometimes, we live this contradictory lifestyle. We compartmentalize life at church away from life at work. And the intoxication just keeps going and makes us vulnerable to this hypocrisy. So what does this one look like? I'm betting perhaps this morning amongst first and second service, we maybe even have a Herodian here in the room. Someone who's a shrewd businessman, who takes their business very, very seriously, hardcore, and perhaps sometime recently, or even in the last month or so, you've defrauded someone in a business deal. You cheated them and you know you did. It might be a woman who has a fantastic wardrobe. And she comes to church not to see God, but to be seen by men. Church can be a great place to show off your shoes, right? Maybe it's a young person who comes to the youth group not to connect with God, but to connect with a girl or connect with a clique of sorts. So why? Why does this happen? It's because in this type of religion, you're far more concerned with what other people see than what God sees in you. And it's a dangerous way to live our lives. I want to tell you, if you're a Herod here this morning and you're thinking, hey, I do. I'm just being honest. I'm trying to get better, but I got a little bit of Herod in me. I want to tell you, for what it's worth, I don't think you're a bad person. I think you're a sad person. You have enough religion to make you miserable, but not enough to make you change. And that's a sad way to live. We know Herod died paranoid. He probably died schizophrenic. He died with terrible relationships in his family, and he died exhausted. Because trying to balance two different lives is simply exhausting. And we don't want you to live that way. Here at Northeast Christian Church, we're not about the yeast of the Pharisees that will make you feel beat up and that you don't measure up. It's not about the yeast of Herod that's going to make you feel tired. Our goal here, our purpose, is that you would have a very personal and real relationship with God through His Son, Jesus Christ. That's our goal. That's our purpose. Jesus Christ, who came to seek and save that which was lost. I hope we can at least come together on this. And you may disagree with this, but I'm going to say it anyway. Jesus did not come to establish a religion, but to build a relationship with you and with me. I'll even say Jesus is disinterested in religion. I have never been a very religious person, and I don't plan on becoming a religious person. But I do desperately want a relationship with God through Jesus Christ. That's what I want. Now, there are some radical differences between religion and relationship, if you will. With religion, it's all about doctrine. Because doctrine is what you're supposed to believe. It's kind of this churchy word, the tenets of the faith, things that we're going to adhere to and do and not do. But relationship is not about doctrine. Relationship is about trust. It's about who you believe in. Not necessarily about what you believe, but who you believe in. Religion is about rules. What you're going to do or what you're not going to do. Where you're going to go or where you're not going to go. Or what you're going to drink or not going to eat. Those sorts of things. That's what religion is all about. But a relationship is about response. You're responding to the love that you have for another person. Maybe I could explain it this way. A relationship is like that of a son and a father. A son doesn't do what he does for his father because there's some manual that tells him how to be a son. A son does what he does for his father because he respects his father. Because there's a relationship there. Religion is about achieving. I'm going to do. I'm going to work. And so somehow, someday, God will reward or have favor and give me heaven or something else for being more of a good person than a bad person. And frankly, that's an exhausting way to live. But a relationship with Jesus Christ is about receiving what's already been done for you. What's already been done for us. It's about recognizing and receiving what God did for us through Jesus Christ on the cross. Let me take you back to the boat for a minute. Mark chapter 8. The very first verse that we read today, Jesus says, "Watch out for the yeast of the Pharisees and that of Herod." You know where he was when he said that? Jesus was in a boat with them. They were in the middle of a lake called the Lake of Galilee. And if you were in that boat and would look over your shoulder to the northwest, there's some mountains there, and that's where the Jews lived. That's Jewish territory. And if you looked the other direction, that's where the Gentiles lived, the complete opposite side of the lake. But where the Jews were, when Jesus was there, that's where he fed 5,000 people with 5 loaves of bread, right? A phenomenal miracle, also one of great love for the Jewish people. But on the other side with the Gentiles, and I promise you, when the disciples went there with him, they were very uncomfortable. That's kind of like the other side of the tracks, not the kind of people you'd want to be with. And yet there, Jesus takes how many? 7 loaves, right? And feeds 4,000 people. Now, if you go to the grocery store and you buy a loaf of bread, that's not what I want you to picture here. Picture instead maybe like a piece of pita. And so Jesus takes 7 pieces of pita and feeds 4,000 people. They ask, well, how are we supposed to feed them? And he says, you know, begin to distribute the loaves. And so they do. And miraculously enough was there to feed 4,000 people. So, now we're in the boat, and we're in the middle of this lake, and they have 1 piece of pita amongst 12 guys. And Jesus says this, watch out for the yeast, watch out for the leaven, if you will, of that of the Pharisees and that of Herod. And the disciples are like, I mean, they're guys, it's like, leaven? Wait, that's what's in bread. I'm hungry. Are you hungry? Why didn't you buy the bread? Who was supposed to buy the bread? All of a sudden, they're caught up about they don't have enough bread, and it's like Jesus is standing there saying, guys, come on. I mean, on that side of the lake, fed 5,000. On this side of the lake, fed 4,000. And you guys are standing here in this boat worried that we don't have enough food. The problem was not about how much food they had, but it was the amount of faith that they had. And so again, here's Jesus on one side of the lake, 5,000, and here, 4,000. That's with the 4,000, that's 1 loaf for every 571 people. I mean, if Jesus had done the same miracle here in the boat, he would have sunk the boat with pita bread, right? And these guys are worried about what's in their hand. And that's the thing. Religion asks the question, what's in your hand? You say, God, what do I need to do? What talents do I have? What deeds do I have? What's in my hand right now? What do I need to do? It's the wrong question. The question that relationship says is, who's in your boat? Because if Jesus is in your boat, it doesn't matter what you have in your hand. You have everything sufficient for the challenges that you'll face. I'm hoping that if we can understand the difference between religion and relationship, then maybe we can understand a sermon that Jesus gave that followed the feeding of the 5,000. John chapter 6, turn there with me, starting in verse 28. But this is the very next day. A few thousand people come and hear Jesus preach in this little synagogue in Capernaum. And in the middle of the sermon, they ask Jesus this question. Verse 28, then they asked him, what must we do the works God requires? Jesus answered, the work of God is this, to believe in the one he has sent. Religion asks, what must we do the works God requires? What's in my hand? What do I have to do to have God recognize me? What do I have to do to impress the people around me? And Jesus says, here's the answer. The work of God is this, to believe in the one he has sent. In a nutshell, as you know, drill down as much as you can, that's it. Wait, you mean I don't have to fast? What about going to church every week and studying the Bible and memorizing scripture and praying? And those are all good things, friends. But they ought to all build on believing the one he has sent. That's what's most important. It's about having a relationship with Jesus Christ. If you have a living, growing relationship with Jesus Christ, you will desire to do these things. I didn't use as much yeast as first service. But the whole time we've been talking, the yeast has been doing what it does. It's been expanding. It's been working. I don't know if you've noticed, but slowly, imperceptibly, it expands and it affects the entire lump of dough. And it just creeps into our lives. And the leaven of the Pharisees, this type of fanaticism that will make you feel good about feeling bad, it will affect your entire religious experience if you're not careful. Watch out, Jesus says. Or the leaven of Herod, it will creep into everything. It's this fraudulent religion that makes you feel bad about feeling good. And subtly, slowly, it will affect your entire religious experience and that of your kids and your kids' kids. And you will be forever exhausted. And Jesus says, be careful about this because it will affect your relationship with me. And so here's the question. Whether this has influenced you or not, here's the question that will help you determine if your religious experience has been contaminated by the yeast of the Pharisees or that of Herod. Do you get your spiritual security from comparison or connection? The Pharisees, they go to church to compare themselves to other people at church to see if they measure up. Do I know as much as he does? Do I dress like she does? The Herods, they compare themselves not to people at church, but to people at work. Is my car as new as theirs? Is my house as big as theirs? Is my influence at work as grand as theirs? But friends, anytime we compare ourselves to other people to determine whether we're right with God, it's the wrong question. And Jesus is inviting you to a connection, to a relationship, not comparison with others. And so how do we do that? Well, for the men in the boat with Jesus that day, the solution was to remember. Again, he says, guys, remember what I've done. Over there I fed 5,000, over here I fed 4,000. Why are you guys worried about the loaf that's in your hand? Remember what I've done. And I just want to challenge you this morning, if we can remember what Jesus has done for us on the cross, if we can focus on what he's done for us on the cross, what has been done for us, it'll make it so much easier to avoid the influence of the yeast of the Pharisees and that of Herod. In just a moment, the group is going to come forward and we're going to sing a song of decision. And during this time, I just want to challenge you to have a really good memory as well. Maybe you need to take a spiritual inventory, and you can stand and sing, or you can remain quiet and just be meditating on this, but take the moment to take a spiritual inventory of where things are at. What has Jesus done for you spiritually? What has Jesus done for you at home? I mean, maybe it's your marriage relationship has been based on Him, or raising your kids have been based on your faith in Him. Maybe it's at work. And you need to consider, what has Jesus done for me at work by allowing me a place of employment where I can go and use my gifts and talents ultimately to spread His fame? Maybe your family. It's a situation where you need to remember what Jesus has done for you through generation after generation of faithfulness to God. Regardless of what kind of inventory you're prepared to take, I just want to challenge you to consider what God has done for you, because He so desires to have a relationship with you. Let's pray.